Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 186 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have three cases today as we deal with technical issues. Pat's on the road, and I'm somewhat technologically strapped right now. We have one from the Indiana Supreme Court, one from the Supreme Court of the United States, and one from the Seventh Circuit. And one more we will cover in the COVID-19 BI segment, also from the Seventh Circuit.
As you mentioned technical issues, it's good I had my microphone turned just off because they just decided to make an announcement right in my ear. So Wow. If during the show I all of a sudden cut off, that's because they're making announcements and there's no, unlike Dan, I travel, but not enough to go to the Sky Club or whatever. So I am hit. Yeah. I am sitting amongst the hoi polloi who are going to learn more about law than they really want to know. Probably more than I want to know. But yes, probably. Periodically there's going to be some noises on my end. Otherwise, when I'm not talking, I'm going to mute myself.
Thanks. The first case today is from the Indiana Supreme Court, Lobster Restaurants LLC, Progressive Flooring Services Inc., and Dwayne Featheroff versus Abigail Frick. The second is from the Supreme Court of the United States, FBI versus Fickrey. The third is from the Seventh Circuit, Kahn versus Walmart.
Dan did not misspeak. We have Frick. And we have Fickrey. So they're two very similar names, two very different issues.
Yeah, very much. So turning to our first case, have an accepted transfer in Red Lobster Restaurants LLC, Progressive Flooring Services Inc., and Dwayne Featheroff versus Abigail Frick. The Indiana Supreme Court will decide whether judicial estoppel applies to bar the plaintiff's complaint because she failed to disclose the asset in the bankruptcy and then did not disclose the bankruptcy in her answers to discovery in a tort case. The court described the case thusly, quote, Frick and Red Lobster, sued Red Lobster after falling in one of its restaurants. Red Lobster moved for summary judgment, arguing Frick lacked standing and her claim is barred by a judicial estoppel because she failed to disclose a pending bankruptcy in her interrogatory answers. Frick responded with an affidavit disclaiming an intent to hide the bankruptcy. Red Lobster then moved to strike her affidavit as contradictory. The Marion Superior Court denied both motions. An interlocutory appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed, finding that Frick's affidavit was not contradictory, judicial estoppel did not apply, and Frick had standing despite being a bankruptcy debtor. The Indiana Supreme Court has granted Red Lobster's petition to transfer and assume jurisdiction over the case. End quote. Pat, tell us about this interesting case.
The first thing, Dan, as always, when we talk about things from the Indiana Supreme Court is about transfer, and as Dan just said, they took transfer, and I don't know why. Because they seem to be entirely on board with the plaintiff's argument, which was the argument that was successful in the trial court and the argument that was successful in the appellate court. So I don't, usually, if they're going to take a case, any Supreme Court or court that has discretion over whether to take a case, sometimes it's an appellate court that wants to take that gets presented with a question for them to answer. But every case that goes to the Indiana Supreme Court, the Illinois Supreme Court, Supreme Court of the United States, they get to decide whether they want to hear this thing or not. Usually they're taking it because they want to do something. It doesn't sound like they want to do anything with this case other than say, yep. Am I missing anything there, Dan, at least from the oral argument, that they're just like, they're saying to Red Lobster, why are you here? What is your beef?
Yeah, I have the same thing. It's not clear why they took it. And as you mentioned, Pat, in Indiana, the Supreme Court, a lot of times they don't grant transfer ahead of it, and that's the first step, and here they have. So,
I would have been very interested to hear the parties say why they should take the case, but the court has already decided it's worth them taking. Now, it may be they took the case because they want to make it clear that judicial estoppel for these purposes is basically dead. It's right. You don't bother with this anymore. Maybe there's a bunch of these motions, and they're kind of annoyed about it. They want to get rid of it, but... You know, it seems that they weren't going very far with this trial judge. Didn't go anywhere with the appellate court. And the Indiana isn't a state that has multiple districts within its appellate court. You know, Illinois has one appellate court, but it has multiple districts, and they sometimes disagree with each other. That's not the case in Indiana. In Indiana, you've got one appellate court, and it sits in they all sit in Indianapolis, just down the hall from the Supreme Court, and so it's a fundamentally different situation. So you don't really have splits. This is the view of the Indiana appellate court, is that, and now I'll get to my sarcasm, is you get to lie in the bankruptcy court, you get to lie to the trustee, you get to lie to the trial court, you get to lie in your answers to interrogatories, and then you can fix it by submitting an affidavit and say, oh, I'm sorry. And because the defendant, Red Lobster in this case, shouldn't get the benefit of the plaintiff's prevarications. And I just don't understand that. You know, what benefit did she get was another question. Well, she had a year or so where she didn't have to pay benefits. And this brings me to the other part of it. Why in the world, and I don't know enough about bankruptcy law to understand this. We've talked about this particular issue before. About this particular issue, I mean judicial estoppel in the bankruptcy context. But why in the world, and that was in the Dunover case versus Clark Material Handling from the Illinois Supreme Court, is why in the world does the trustee not throw an absolute fit? If this case has value, if Ms. Frick was injured and she has the ability to pay back her creditors, why wouldn't her creditors be jumping up and down to the trustee to go get this asset, take it over, take the case, and get some money back? Maybe it's enough to pay them back. It depends how much in debt Ms. Frick was. I don't know. This doesn't seem to be a case. This is not, Doug, listen to me. This does not seem to be a case where the injury put her into bankruptcy. I think she was in bankruptcy. And then, you know, sometimes, you know, a person gets injured, they lose their job, they lose their health insurance, they don't have coverage. So they go really deep into debt. And the one asset they've got, or an asset of some value, because they don't own their house, they're probably underwater in that, they're underwater in their car. I mean, the person's in financial duress and or dire straits at the very least. And this person has an asset, the personal injury action. Well, this personal injury action, if she can show you know, duty breach causation and damage of sufficient size, that may pay back a lot, if not all, of her creditors, and may even leave her out. She may not be bankrupt if the asset has sufficient value. I don't know, but I don't understand why the trustee isn't in here saying, no, this is my asset, I'm taking it. When did the bankruptcy trustees, maybe they've always been this way, when did the bankruptcy trustees become so charitable that we're going to let the bankrupt person? I mean, the object of bankruptcy is to do justice between everybody. This woman took on this debt. You know, we don't throw people in jail anymore, nor should we, for failing to pay debt. There's a case right now where in Cook County where a litigant has been ordered to pay money to his lawyers in a family proceeding. And he was in lockup for weeks. And that's obviously raised a concern about debtor's prison, which we got rid of, not only in Illinois, but all over the place, and rightfully so, sometime in the 19th century. So we're not throwing people in jail. We have a system that is designed to be fair between everybody, and I don't understand. So, you can't be fair in this circumstance. She doesn't disclose the thing. You know, a person who declares bankruptcy typically will have not one, but two lawyers, a bankruptcy lawyer and a personal injury lawyer in a situation like this. And either the lawyers aren't asking the questions or the person's lying to them. And then they're lying to the trustee when they get asked, which is what happened in the Dunover case. The person didn't. Oh, I didn't have a claim. I lost my leg, but I didn't have a claim. Or I think that's what it is. He suffered this catastrophic injury. I don't know. No, I didn't have a claim. I didn't have a workers' comp claim. Didn't have a personal injury. No. He had both of those claims. Very valuable claims. You lose an appendage. They pay you for that if you could show that there was a duty and it was breached and it caused the injury. Then losing a leg, that's mucho dinero, where I come from, and rightfully so if they could prove the elements of the claim. But the leg, you know, this woman here, I don't know how bad her injury was, but I don't understand, number one, why the court is countenancing this. They almost want to see, like, that's a bankruptcy court problem. And if the bankruptcy trustee doesn't care, why should we care? Well, shouldn't we all care? about the integrity of the system? Shouldn't we all care that when people sign an answer to interrogatory, which is under oath, or testify before a trustee, which is under oath, or sign a bankruptcy petition, which is under oath, or tell their lawyer that he then signs, and he doesn't do it under oath typically, but it's signed, you know, under Rule 11 in Indiana, which is very similar, if not the same, to Federal Rule 11, or in Illinois, Rule 137. He's signing, you know, having done an appropriate investigation, and I'm quite certain he would have asked about bankruptcy, because that's going to affect how and whether he takes the case. And so this person's been asked, and they've got lawyers all over the place. They ask the question on the bankruptcy petition: do you have any lawsuits? Do you have any claims? Do you have any this, that? It's very specific. And you've got to answer that. Yeah, I know it's a lot of documents, and you know, I sometimes get tired of the claim. Well, I don't understand things. You know, okay, then don't sign things. If you don't understand them, you've got to ask. One of the questions, one of the statements you make at the beginning of a deposition, you say to the witness, if you don't understand one of my questions, tell me. And I will rephrase it, because I may use a word you don't understand, or you may not hear me because we're on Zoom or whatever it happens to be. If you don't understand it, you gotta tell me, because I don't know. But if you answer the question, then it's followed by this statement. If you answer a question, we're going to assume the answer you gave to the question that I asked, that you understood my question. And that's said in every deposition that I've ever conducted, every examination under oath I've conducted, because I don't want the person to come back later and say they didn't understand. So don't go around signing things you don't actually understand. So I didn't understand. Well, maybe you should have spoke up till you did. And if you're so ignorant that you didn't understand that you didn't understand, that's what your lawyers are for. And it should. And it's not a question, as the court seemed to be focused on, a benefit to Red Lobster. It's a detriment to the system. Judicial estoppel doesn't exist to protect defendants from lying plaintiffs. That's not its purpose. Its purpose is to defend the system, and it should defend the system. That's all I've got, as the people here at Kennedy Airport decide to make noise.
Well, Pat, this is an interesting case, and you're right about judicial estoppel and the integrity of the system. You know, this is a case where
that was the equivalent of being played off stage at the Oscars,
right? You know, where if she can prove standing while falling, again, it's like you said, there's disclosures and things. But you and I've talked about in the past, some clients, for whatever reason, they'll be asked questions. Have you ever been sued? And they say no. And then, you know, lo and behold, the other side, and you ask them, and you have to have some trust with your clients, right? And whether you're plaintiffs, defendants, commercial versus commercial. And sometimes they don't disclose, and then you come back to them and say, well, why did you not say this? And they say, well, I didn't think it was a big deal. And that's, you know, like you said, in depositions, everything, you explain to them, I need to know everything. And I'm going to presume that you understand the question if you answer it, like you said. And so, very interesting situation here. Like you said, I'll be interested to see what the order is in this case, and maybe we'll get a glimpse into why they took it and what the major relevance is, because it's unclear in this case, unlike some cases, why they took a transfer here.
And let me add, so this week on the Short Circuit podcast, which is a podcast from the Institute for Justice, talks about cases that are decided from the circuit courts of appeals. And they had a case they were discussing from the Fourth Circuit, where they remanded for a new trial, where it was a police brutality case. And the officer was asked asked in discovery, do you have any other cases where you are alleged to have committed police brutality? And he said no. He gets on the stand and he says, no, I don't have any other cases. Well, lo and behold, after he gets off the stand, plaintiff's counsel finds out that there is not one but two other cases, one of which is defended by the same defense lawyer, if I remember the facts correctly. And they go, and so they get done with this case. They lose the trial. They file their post-trial motion. The trial judge, the district court judge, denies that motion. It goes to the First Circuit. They remand it back, and they say, this could have impacted the jury. He just got done lying. All he asked for was to recall the defendant and be able to ask him, so why'd you lie to me about this other case that apparently had very similar facts, where the defendant was handcuffed and got beat with a pipe? That's the allegation. I don't know if it happened in either case, but it might be relevant putting the 404 issues aside, which they did talk about, putting the 404B issues aside. But it would be relevant if he had said, you know, yes, I have, or, you know, why'd you lie about that? That'd be something the jury would be very interested in, because they don't like liars, and liars don't usually win a jury trial. Once they know that you've lied and you've had to get on the stand and said that you've lied, now the, whoever the party is, plaintiff, defendant, don't matter, you're in trouble with that jury, typically. Yep. And so that, but it's the same kind of situation. You can't go around. You got to tell the truth, and you got to know about your lawsuits. Now, this is a police officer, and he had a lawyer, and they're at trial, and they didn't disclose it, and it was a discovery violation, a bunch of other things. But the same principle applies. How do you not know? How do you not know? So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with FBI versus FCRA.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment two of episode 186 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And following the decision in Atchison Hotels versus Laufer, mootness is at SCOTUS again. This time, the court is considering FBI versus FCRA, in which the question presented is, quote, are respondents' claims challenging his placement on the no-fly list moot, given that he was removed from the no-fly list in 2016, and the government provided a sworn declaration that he, quote, will not be placed on the no-fly list in the future based on the currently available information, end quote, and end of the question presented. Oye described the facts of the case thusly. In 2010, Jonas FCRA, a United States citizen of Eritrean descent, was placed on the FBI's no-fly list when he was traveling to the Sudan. I don't know. Why does Sudan get an article in front of it? You know, it's not the Egypt, but it is the Sudan. Anyway, I don't know why. Some places get a the in front. The Sudan is one of those for some reason.
Yep.
FBI agents questioned him about his ties to a mosque in Portland, Oregon, and informed him he was a flight risk. I assume that meant not that he was going to fly. They weren't going to let him fly because they were worried he was going to flee. That's what I take flight risk to mean in this case. good pun. FCRA was offered removal from the list in exchange for becoming an FBI informant, an offer he declined for Mr. FCRA. Subsequently, FCRA was imprisoned and tortured in the United Arab Emirates. That's what you get when you don't become an informant. Apparently, they take you to the UAE and they torture you. Allegedly, at the request of the FBI, he was taken to the UAE and tortured. Unable to return to the U.S., FCRA sought asylum in Sweden, but was he apparently had family there, by the way, but was ultimately denied and returned to Portland via private jet after his petition to be removed from the no-fly list was denied. While still in Sweden, FCRA filed a lawsuit against the FBI claiming violation of his Fifth Amendment right to due process. Keep in mind, FCRA is a United States citizen.
Yes.
While the lawsuit was pending, the FBI removed him from the no-fly list. A district court in Portland or in Oregon dismissed FCRA's case as moot, given that he had been removed from the no-fly list. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reinstated the lawsuit, stating that under the voluntary cessation doctrine, it was not absolutely clear that FCRA would not be placed back on the list for the same reasons. The case returned to the district court when an FBI official filed a declaration that FCRA would not be put back on the list based upon current information. Despite this declaration, the court once again dismissed the case. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit again reversed, reasoning that the FBI's declaration did not indicate a change in the policies or procedures that put FCRA on the list in the first place. Dan, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Pat. And again, this No-Fly Act was after 2001, part and parcel and kind of related to the special designated nationals list. There are a lot of false positives up front with names and things. Pat, this is an interesting case. I, as you know, do a lot of moot court judging, and I believe it was the UIC Herzog over the summer or in the fall, maybe the winter even, that had this case before it was argued. They can't look.
You
at
do so many, you can't even keep track of them.
Well, I do the UIC moot court about three times a year with a good friend that I was at the beginning of my legal career in private practice, Chris Osborne. And I'm almost positive it was there. And so very interesting arguments, and you kind of gave the facts. The oral arguments, if people listen to them, and I commend it. This was just recently, January 8th the 8th. The justices were kind of I think, like we've talked about in some of the other Supreme Court cases recently passed, I think that they're going to probably find some kind of narrow ruling. I think their concern was this, is you mentioned kind of Mr. Fikre's his ordeal. He's never been told why he was on a list. Kagan, I think it was, suggested that the process would be to have some in-camera type of setting where he would learn at least why he was on the list.
Gorsuch suggested that as well.
And Gorsuch agreed with it, yeah, and I think Alito was even on board. I think it's an interesting case. There was arguments that this case is moot, like you said, because he was removed from the list. But the concern here, unlike the case we talked about with the hotels and the ADA claims where the lady was never going to visit and they released it in mootness, is here he's got some kind of generic statement somehow from the FBI that they're not going to put him on the no-fly list again. But the reality is, again, is he, his lawyers, his family, nobody seems to really understand or know what caused and triggered him to be on the no-fly list. And so how he has any assurances that in the future, he's not going to face the same thing. If he goes and flies, as you mentioned, he got over to Sudan and then he got back through a private jet was not in the facts that OAA said, but we know that from the moot court again.
And it was on a one-time waiver, and we know that from the oral argument. One-time waiver to come back to the United States, and apparently the government of Sweden arranged for that private jet, probably because they just wanted to get him out of there.
Yeah. And the one advocate, Josh, he acknowledged that the FBI uses a strategy dealing with the merits of challenges to placements on the no-fly list to go before a judge. And again, there's FISA judges, there's judges that are for these national security issues that you can go in and it's all under seal. So, and again, he might not know what the reason is, but at least the FBI or somebody could explain to the court exactly what caused this trigger. Like I said, if you listen to oral argument, and this was one of the shorter ones, it wasn't as long as some of the ones, right?
This went on for a while. It was an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's
shorter by current standards. Although the one I'm listening to right now is less than an hour and a half, so maybe.
Yeah, so it's relevant, but it's longer than it used to be. But a very interesting argument, like you said, Kagan and Gorsuch both kind of suggested this approach. Alito seemed to be concerned about this as well. And so I don't think this court will dismiss this case for mootness. I think they need to address this issue of how you go about this guy's rights. Like you said, he's a citizen, so this is not a case where some no-fly people and no-travel people after 9/11 were not citizens of the United States, and so. Our Constitution, as we looked at in 9/11 and other terrorism issues, when you're a citizen, you've still got rights. You didn't give up your citizenship rights, even if you're doing things that are related to terrorism and things adverse to the country. At least you don't lose them up front. And so one of the things Gorsuch raised is a right. What he referred to as every man's evidence against them is that you're entitled, again, in the United States under due process and basic notions of due process, you're entitled to know what evidence is against you, and so you can defend yourself, and you can take actions to alleviate or address or rebut those. And so I think this will be an interesting decision, Pat. I think we'll see kind of a mixed folks, and as you and I've talked about in the past, on a lot of criminal procedure matters and a lot of things that, that move over into kind of the criminal realm, Kagan and Sotomayor and Gorsuch and others sometimes are very much aligned. And so this whole, you know, the ideological split thing is not necessarily, you know, in place in the in these types of cases. So
I have several things to add, Dan. The first is, I think the key part of the oral argument was things were going along pretty well for Ficre's lawyer until the very end when Justice Alito asked, what do you want?
Right.
And he could not articulate what remedy. One of the aspects, you know, sometimes we mix standing and mootness, but they kind of collide. This is a mootness case. What redress does he want? He couldn't articulate what red, and I think that's a real problem for him.
And he called it, as you said, Alito called it a very perplexing case. And yeah,
and Alito, who's never found a criminal defendant he'll rule for, that's saying it's quite a thing when he says, he loves ruling for the government, and in this case, he's just like, I don't understand how this is going to work. What remedy do you want? You know, it doesn't. Apparently, what happens in cases where the no-fly plaintiff gets past motions to dismiss, they then will share some of the information. Well, this case didn't get past the motion to dismiss, so it seems that the government's willing to share it with some people. And you know, there was discussion of, you know, going to a SCIF, which is a secure location where you can look at things and figure it out. Because Ficre's point is, well, what put me on the list in the first place? Nothing that I've done in the past, fine. But what if I go back to that mosque? Was that the one that's going to put me over the top? And obviously that's the kind of thing that the government doesn't want to give up, is tell right. him what put you on the list. Where were we looking that would give up sources and methods?
And national security risk, right? There could be
Well, that's
other
what they
risks.
Claim, yeah.
Yeah.
But then the other aspect of this case is the FBI offers this affidavit that essentially says, trust us.
Right.
And we've had those kinds of affidavits before. In the 8.4G context, we've talked about that in the Wahaki case, Wahaki versus Greenberg, where the government says, trust us, we're not going to prosecute you. It's like, well, why voluntarily – this is under the voluntary cessation doctrine. It's like, we're not going to do it anymore. Yeah, we did you wrong before. We've done you wrong for a long time. We apparently did you very wrong by getting you to the UAE to be tortured.
Right.
We kept you out of the country for half a decade. You had to sue us to be able to get taken off the list, and only after you got an exemption to come back while you were still on the list. He was still on the list for 3 years after he sued them. And now I'm supposed to trust you? You know, we're 7 years. He's been off the list for 7 years. We don't know. He still doesn't know what put him on the list. He claims, obviously, that he's, you know, innocent and didn't do anything, wasn't involved in terrorist activities or supporting them or anything of the kind. And maybe that's true and maybe that's not. I don't know. But, you know, if the government was willing to take him off the list, then they must not think that he's a very bad guy. And
right.
if they were willing to grant the one-time waiver for him to come back, they must not think he's a very bad guy.
Right.
Mistakes happen. I get it. But I don't understand why the government, why Mr. Ficre has to take their word for it, because it's you don't find out you're on the no-fly list until you can't book a flight, and then he won't know what put him back on the flight, or sorry, put him back on the list. I really struggle with this. Is a very difficult case because I don't know what remedy he's entitled to at this.
And
point.
going to that, Alito, like you said, he asked about this statement by Ficre's counsel that you know, he could be put back on the list again. And even Chief Justice Roberts said, you know, the statement by the FBI is enough, that, you know, they can't go any further to say, you know, at this point, we don't intend to put him back in the no-fly list. So, like I said, Pat, it's going to be very difficult. And if you read the analysis and kind of the people that have really experts in this area. I think they're again talking about a very narrow decision that will somehow address the issues here, but not not have some broad principle or rule, I don't think.
I agree with that. It may be very specific to these group of cases. It's almost like, tell me if this analogy is misplaced, it's almost like the opposite of when did you stop beating your wife? The government right. basically says, well, we stopped beating. We stopped, 7 years ago. We promised not to do it again. Right. Whereas that one's the backward looking is by saying, when did you stop beating your wife? That presumed you beat your wife in the first place. This is, we beat you in the past. We're not going to beat you anymore. And in his case, right. Mr. Vickrey's case, apparently, or allegedly, quite literally, he was beaten. We promised not to do it anymore. And I think it's just as ineffective. It's just as bad a question of when did you stop beating your wife as it is to say, I won't do it anymore. I've done you wrong and now I'm not going to do it anymore. It's like, I don't have to. Why do I have to believe you? I don't know why the FBI has to be believed in this circumstance when they can't come up with good reasons why this fellow was put on. They won't disclose. And I understand why they won't disclose, but you can understand the skepticism. If you're not going to say, and you're just going to say national security, and unfortunately, in my view, national security has been used as a reason to hide all kinds of shenanigans that the government wants to do. And courts have been all too willing to just, accede to that. It's like, well, national security. Oh, well, then nothing doing here. And when in fact, it's often quite the opposite. There's quite a lot doing here that needs judicial oversight, especially when we're dealing with a U.S. person. This is, that's especially problematic. So. With that, we'll take our next break and we'll come back with Walmart or Khan versus Walmart.
Hey, Podium and Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 186. Does Walmart engage in a systematic practice of charging more for items at the register than at that which is displayed on the shelf? And if so, does that practice violate the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act and the Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act? That is essentially the question to be answered when the Seventh Circuit decides Khan versus Walmart, argued this past week. The plaintiff, a tester, purchased muffins at a Walmart location at Niles, probably right by my house, Pat, and discovered after the transaction that he was charged more than what was displayed. The plaintiff filed an action alleging violation of various statutes, and the court dismissed the complaint under Rule 12b-6. For its part, Walmart argued that there is no systemic pattern of deception of informed fairness, that the plaintiff has pointed to a couple of examples of errors, which is insufficient, and the receipt, along with the mandated price display at the register before the transaction is completed, resolves the issue. Pat, tell us about this interesting case.
Thanks, Dan. And this is a case primarily under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, although also under the Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and there's also an unjust enrichment claim that, based on a question from Judge Hamilton, isn't going very far because it seems to be duplicative of the Consumer Fraud Act claim, which, I maybe have grown into Judge Easterbrook, but I find that he kept referring it to as ICFA. I find that annoying. It's a Consumer Fraud Act claim. It's fine. And Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act, easy for me to say. I mean, it won't kill you to say the name of the thing. The issue here is, and this is the point made by defense counsel, is a typical Walmart store has, 100,000 items in there, and you found one mistake? Good for you. Our policy is, if you find the mistake, we'll give it to you at the price on the shelf. We display, as we have to under statute or regulation, what the price is when you get to the register. We've all had the circumstance. I'll never forget my daughter's grandmother. Is English. She doesn't speak English very well. This is many years ago when she really didn't speak English very well. And she goes to the Walgreens and she picks out a couple items and she gets to the front and they charge her $6. And she says in her 2 for $5. And then the story goes that the right, the cashier looks at her and goes, says, 2 for $5. And they go back to the thing. And sure enough, it was $2. It was two of the items for $5. That's what she was going to pay. So this is a woman that doesn't even speak English very well, doesn't read the language much at all. But she was able to figure out what the price was of the item and to be able to communicate that she was dissatisfied with how they had rung it up. So, again, anecdote's a bad way to, but I think it makes the point, which is you see it on there, you look at it. If it's wrong, they better give it to you for the price. Otherwise, you do have a problem. And if the point that Walmart made is that this, if this were a systemic issue, you'd find more than one. And so then they cite to some other cases where this had happened in one store in North Carolina, it happened like twice, and one store in Pennsylvania, it happened like 6 times. And it was interesting that counsel for the plaintiff tried to use the amicus brief filed by the retail merchants to say, see, it is systematic. So what they do, the way the process works is they change it on the shelf, and then they scan it, and then it gets uploaded the next day. So they do that at night, and then uploaded the next day onto the register. So there's a lag period of time when this occurs. So this plaintiff was, as described by Chief Justice Sykes, as a tester. You know, not unlike we started off the show talking about, last segment we started off talking about the Atchison Hotel case, talking about a tester.
Right.
There's no question this person has standing. The question is whether he has a cause of action. And whether he's alleged a pervasive pattern. If they could make out a pervasive pattern of we're intentionally overcharging our customers, well, that's a different kettle. That would be a Consumer Fraud Act claim, but that's not what they've seemed to have alleged. It seems they found one item out of at least tens of thousands, if not 100,000 items, that was mispriced. Okay, we'll give it to you for the right price. So I don't know if I see, because it has to be a practice that's unfair, that's oppressive, and so forth. And frankly, my view is that if they have one item out of 100,000 that's mispriced, that's good faith. That's doing a remarkable job of making sure those things match, because there's humans involved in this process. So I don't think this is going very far. I don't think the plaintiff is good, but it's a very interesting case because it's a very damning allegation, especially against Walmart, where price is so much of their business. And I had an exchange with someone online that represents plaintiffs and consumer fraud actions of this kind. And he made the point, well, they say, you know, save money. Walmart's about saving money and always low prices. And that's like, they didn't say the lowest price. They didn't say we're going to always save. They said, you know, we charge less. That's what they do. And I think we all can say from our experience, that's what Walmart does. They've done it for very, very many years and done it very successfully. But I don't think that, maybe this pattern exists. Maybe this practice does exist, but this plaintiff doesn't seem to have alleged it. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Pat. And, I have been in situations like this where the sign, sales haven't been taken down or other things. And then sometimes, depending on the store you're at, whether it's Jewel or, a local store or Walmart, or they may get into a debate with you. I've had situations like that where the cashier is like, well, that's no longer the deal. And you're like, well, that's what's posted on this, by the product. And here's the thing, I pulled down the sign, or whatever. But I think, like you said, if it's one product out of 100,000, I'm not an expert on this. And, if this tester thinks that this is really happening, you would think that he would have
He'd have dozens of examples over the course of weeks, example on one day.
And it'd be multiple Walmarts, and he would go from one to the next. The one in Niles, which is right by my house. It's probably the one right by my house in Niles, but I think there's only one in Niles. But there's one in Skokie.
There may be only one away. Walmart, but there's probably 5 Starbucks.
I don't think this case is going very far, but interesting case.
Indeed, it's certainly a salacious allegation. The other thing is that this oral argument was scheduled, or at least it lasted 45 minutes. The court was at least interested in hearing from these advocates on this topic. When I saw a 45-minute argument, I was like, whoa, what's this all about? Knowing Walmart, and there's been cases percolating about employment discrimination and things like this, I didn't expect it to be this kind of a case. This seemed to be one that was more appropriate for, a 20-minute argument as opposed to a 45-minute argument, based on how the questioning went. But it was a 45-minute argument.
Well,
I think they got a lot of amicus briefs.
And at the Seventh Circuit, as we've talked about, there are many cases we've covered that are 21 to 25 minutes. So this, the fact that it went 45 minutes is, like I said, some interest on the part of the Seventh Circuit to figure this out.
It also appeared to be the first case of the day, which means it was the one they were going to plan on taking the longest, because it goes, they take the ones that are going to take longer typically first, and then it gets, as you're later in the day, they give you less time. So the 20-minute cases are at the end, and the longer cases, whether they're a half hour, 45 minutes, whatever, very rarely an hour, those go at the beginning. This one was the first case of that particular day. With that brings us to our BIPA, BI for COVID, GIPA, and IPA segment. And we actually have material, Dan, one of which is from the Seventh Circuit, as Dan mentioned at the top. There's still a COVID-19 case percolating. This is a case called Q Excelsior Italia SRL versus Zurich. This is a hotel in Rome that alleges COVID-19 business interruption damages, and they think that they've pled enough to get around all the problems and plead around Sandy Point and Crescent Hotel and Sweetberry. So the first two cases from the Seventh Circuit, Sweetberry, of course, from the Illinois Appellate Court. And they've asked for certification, which drew quite the ire from Judge Hamilton. He said, hold it now. You filed in federal court, and now you say you want us to certify it to the Illinois Supreme Court? If you wanted that, why don't you just file in state court? Right. That's bizarre. You've asked us to decide the thing, and you can't point me to any Illinois Appellate Court case that says otherwise. And I think the Illinois Supreme Court has denied at least a half dozen, if not well more than that, petitions for leave to appeal. They've had an ample opportunity to say that the Illinois appellate courts have gotten this all wrong, which they haven't done. So there's that. There also was a North Carolina appellate court argument on a COVID-19 case, a New Jersey appellate court that ruled in favor of an insurer. And Dan, I want to say there was a Massachusetts court that came down in favor of an insurer. Have I got that right?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
It didn't make it into the notes, but it was in my brain that had occurred.
It did happen. And as we've talked about, this is these are the last the crumbs of this issue, or getting close to it. We're 4 years out from. I mean, it's got to be. There can't be many more cases percolating.
Right. The California cases, as we've mentioned.
Yeah, they're still percolating. But so we'll continue to address those as they come up. But, I don't think this Italian hotel is going to be successful, but we'll see.
Indeed, which brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong. We are now 289.5, 59.5, and 19. And I'm sorry, Dan, that's Dan's, and I'm 286.5, 62.5, and 19. And Dan, why don't you tell about Artesian so they don't have to hear about the boarding call?
Yeah, and Pat, because of my technical difficulties, I haven't really looked at that case.
It's good. The boarding has apparently occurred, so I can tell us about Artesian. Artesian is a case we discussed back on our episode from October 29th. This involved a crane that was part of a vehicle. And there was a operations exclusion in the policy, and the question was priority of coverage, and the courts, or whether there was coverage under the auto policy. The trial court held that there was a duty to defend, and the appellate court sat reversed and said no. There's coverage for the under the Burlington policy, which was an ordinary CGL policy, but not under the commercial auto policy, which had an operations exclusion. So that brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong for this week, Dan. And Dan, what do you think about Red Lobster? I think this is going to get affirmed, right?
Affirmed.
And then FBI versus FICRE. I don't know if they're going to dismiss. I don't think they're going to dismiss this as moot.
I don't think so either.
Well, You know what? No. I think Justice Alito's questioning was very effective in really struggling with how is it redressable?
Yeah.
And I don't know how they deal with that. I'm punting. I'm going to chicken out because I don't know. There's so many ways they can go with this mootness business.
I think punting's the right answer on this one.
Okay.
Because if we did make a prediction, it'd just be on the mootness, and I think they'll find that it's not moot, but they'll then have some very narrow solution because, like you said, it's, I don't know what the hell they do with it.
I don't know because I don't know what remedy that he wants at the, what remedy he wants or could get at this point.
Yeah,
and that brings us to Kahn versus Walmart, which I think will be affirmed.
Affirmed.
And then that brings us to last week. We forgot to do the rule of the week, and that's why the title of the last week's show was a bit incongruous. So, though it's the show name last week, we got the show name in this week, but we didn't get the show name in this week. So we're going to get it in this week, Dan, and it comes from the year-end report from Chief Justice Roberts. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So the Chief Justice's report this year end, it started in the Burger Court where he would do a kind of a State of the Union of the Supreme Court. There's been a lot of talk about that this year end and even last year end, Chief Justice Roberts didn't really hit, you know, the issues and things that are really facing the court and, you know, the ethics and all that stuff. But what he focused on was technology and kind of did a nice job of the history, which every one of these reports kind of gives a history of something, history of the technology in the courts and computers and now artificial intelligence, and said that we need to move forward with some caution and that it can be a great tool, but that the court will not be replaced, that the challenges, again, of AI, he mentioned, alluded to the hallucinations that we saw with court filings. But that, you know, the judicial system and appellate advocacy for now is not going anywhere to the wayside. And so it's it was an interesting report loaded with tech. And what was the name of the last episode, Pat? Because
The machines are not going to replace judges anytime soon.
Yeah. And that was his major point. And I think anybody that does AI or is involved in tech has talked about that there's benefits and risk. And one of the things I keep hearing is that AI won't replace us, but those who don't embrace technology and AI, just like any other technology in the past, that those who do embrace it will replace those who don't. So interesting thing. And again, of course, judges won't be replaced by robots, at least not for the foreseeable future.
Judging still requires a human
element, yeah.
So with that, we will take our leave. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this week. Sorry for our technical issues. Hopefully the sound isn't too bad. We'll see you next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.